The following is a class given by His Holiness Jayapataka Swami on April 25th, 1988 at Bhaktivedanta Manor in England. The class begins with a reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, 7th Canto, Chapter 7, Text 26. The following is a class given by His Holiness Jayapataka Swami on May 1st, 1988 in Atlanta, Georgia. The class begins with a reading from the Chaitanya Charitamrita, Madhya Lila, Chapter 19, Text 136 through 143.
Years ago, Sri Krishna Chaitanya Mahaprabhu appeared in the East with Lord Nityananda, and they brought this process of chanting Hare Krishna in a congregation to the masses of people. Lord Chaitanya did not write any books himself. He did not create a new tradition or a new philosophy as such. What he did was simply refer to the original Vedas, especially the Bhagavad Gita and the Srimad Bhagavatam, saying that actually the knowledge was always there, but it had not been properly applied. So therefore, he didn't write any new books. He only wrote 8 verses. But he directed his followers to study the original books, and from there he quoted how to apply it properly. So one time he met one of he was actually the finance minister for the government of the, at that time, the emperor of Hussein Shah, the emperor of Panchagoda, whole northern India, northeastern India. And Rupa Goswami wanted to know from him the essence of spiritual life, what was the real purpose of life. He wanted to surrender to him. So then Lord Chaitanya taught him for 12 days, and in 12 days gave him the entire essence of Krishna consciousness. So there are a few, the beginning lessons that he gave. I just read a few verses from there. Prabhu kohe sanarupo bhakti rasya lakhan, sutarupe kohi bistar najaya varnan. Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, "My dear Rupa, please listen to me. It is not possible to describe devotional service completely. Therefore, I am just trying to give you a synopsis of the symptoms of devotional service. The ocean of the transcendental mellow of devotional service is so big that no one can estimate its length and breadth. However, just to help you taste it, I am describing but one drop. Eto brahmando bhuri ananta jivagan, chorasti loko jonite koraye brahman. In this universe, there are limitless living entities in 8,400,000 species, and all are wandering within this universe. Prabhupada, our founder, Acharya Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, he gives his explanation or purport. This is a challenge to so-called scientists and philosophers who presume that there are living entities on this planet only. So-called scientists are going to the moon and they say that there is no life there. This does not tally with Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's version. He says that everywhere within the universe there are limited numbers of living entities, from 8,400,000 species or forms. In Bhagavad Gita 2.24, we find that the living entities are sarva-gata, which means that they can go anywhere. This indicates that there are living entities everywhere. They exist on land, in water, in air, in fire, and in ether. Thus, there are living entities in all types of material elements. Since the entire material universe is composed of five elements, earth, water, fire, air, and ether, why should there be living entities on one planet and on another? Such a foolish version can never be accepted by Vedic students. In the Vedic literatures, we understand that there are living entities on each and every planet, regardless of whether the planet is composed of earth, water, fire, or ether. These living entities may not have the same forms that we that are found on this planet Earth, but they have different forms composed of different elements. Even on this Earth, we can see that the forms of land animals are different from the forms of aquatic. According to the circumstance, living conditions differ. But undoubtedly, there are living entities everywhere. Why should we deny the existence of living entities on this or that planet? Those who have claimed to have gone to the moon have not gone there, or else their imperfect vision cannot actually perceive the particular type of living entities there. Living entities are described as ananta or unlimited. Nonetheless, they are said to belong to 8,400,000 species. This is explained in the Vishnu Purana. Jalaja navalakshani stavara lakshavinsati trimayo rudra sankhyakha pakshinang dasalakshanam trinsa lakshani pasava chatulakshani manushaha. Translation. There are 900,000 species living in the water. There are also 2 million non-moving living entities, stavar, such as trees and plants. There are also 1,100,000 species of insects and reptiles, and there are 1 million species of birds. As far as quadrupeds are concerned, there are 3 million varieties, and there are 400,000 human species. End of translation. Some of these species may exist on one planet and not on another, but in any case, within all the planets of the universe, and even in the sun, there are living entities. This is the verdict of Vedic literature. As Bhagavad Gita 2.20 confirms, Najayate Miyate Vakadachin Nayanga Bhudva Bhavita Vana Bhuya Ajo Nityang Sasuto Purano Nahanyate Hanyamani Sarire. Translation. For the soul there is never birth nor death, nor having once been does he ever cease to be. He is unborn, eternal, ever-existing, undying, and primeval. He is not slain when the body is slain. Since the living entities are never annihilated, they simply transmigrate from one life form to another. Thus, there is an evolution of forms according to the degree of developed consciousness. One experiences different degrees of consciousness in different forms. A dog's consciousness is different from a man's. Even within a species, we find that a father's consciousness is different from his son, and that a child's consciousness is different from a youth. Just as we find different forms, we find different states of consciousness. When we see different states of consciousness, we may take it for granted that the bodies are different. In other words, different types of bodies depend on different states of consciousness. This is also confirmed in Bhagavad Gita 8.6, Yanyang Vapi Smarang Bhavam. One's consciousness at the time of death determines a type of body of a living entity. This is the process of transmigration of the soul. A variety of bodies is already there. We change from one body to another in terms of our consciousness. So in the universe, there are limitless living entities, 8,400,000 species. This may appear difficult to understand. It. Well, how is it possible that there's life on the moon or on the Mars or in other places? Here on this planet, we see that to sustain life, we require oxygen. So generally, the scientists look on what planet is there oxygen. And if they find the same composition of oxygen, carbon dioxide, etc., they consider that, well, there must be life on that planet. But this is a very narrow-minded viewpoint on what life is. That according to the Vedas, life can exist. There are different forms of life for different environments. And that life is present everywhere in the universe. For instance, recently, there was a very unusual discovery by marine scientists that underneath the surface of the world, of the ocean, beneath the surface of the ocean, there was a volcano or some kind of volcanic eruption coming out. And especially this was the constant flow of ammonia gas. Now, ammonia gas is highly toxic, and any type of living entity that fish or humans or anything that comes in ammonia gas would very quickly die. But they, scientists are very amazed to find that around the ammonia gas coming out from the ocean floor, there were both plant as well as a specific kind of fish which were simply living in the gas. And when they took those plants or fish away from the gas, they would die. And if another ordinary fish would flow in that gas, he'd immediately also die. That there were certain living plants and animals that were the fish, we were actually living off of the ammonia gas. Their metabolism was based on breathing ammonia. Just like the fish breathe oxygen that's dissolved in the water, these fish and plants couldn't breathe oxygen. They could only breathe ammonia. That was the unique thing. So this amazing discovery actually supported the version from the Vedas that living entities are everywhere within the universe. There may be in some places a whole atmosphere of ammonia, so there may be living entities. They breathe ammonia. Or there may be another type of atmosphere, or even a more subtle situation. Living entities can live in all these various types of atmospheres. Just like when a person digs in the ground, you find that underneath the ground there are so many worms, so many living entities that are there in the ground. Even when you go high in the sky, the airplane find that there was a jet ran into a mosquito 30,000 feet above sea level. It got into the engine and caused some disturbance. So there are living entities able to live in all these different extreme environments. So similarly all over the universe. What does this actually mean? How does this apply to us? This means that now we're living here as a human being in this particular planet at this particular place. But actually, we're the living force or the living entity within the body. And for some time, we're here on this planet, in this body, in this country. But after we leave this body, then again we may take birth in any other planet, in any other place. Not only that, in this planet, or even as a human being, but in some other species, or as another type of human being, another place. This is explained from the Vedas. What is the nature of a living entity? Keshagra sata bhagasya satamsa sadishatmaka jiva sukshma sarupo yam sankyati to hichit kanaha. If you divide the tip of a hair into 100 parts and then take one of these parts and divide it again into 100 parts, that very fine division is the size of but one of the numberless living entities. They're all chitkona, particles of spirit, not matter. Krishna explains in the Bhagavad Gita that Mamayavamsa Jiva Loka Jiva Bhuta Sanatana. Prabhupada explains, the living entities in this conditional world, conditioned world, are my, Lord Krishna himself is speaking, are my eternal fragment, my part and parcel. So Krishna is the name of the Supreme Spirit. He is the Supreme Soul. We are small particles of Krishna. Same as the body, whether it's a little ant body, or whether it's an elephant body, whether very small or very large, the actual moving force is this living entity, which is a small spiritual atom, like an atom, like a small spiritual particle. Although it's small, it has more power than millions of suns. It's eternal, it never dies, it can't be divided, it can't be wet. But when the body dies, this little spiritual spark goes again and takes a new birth according to its consciousness, how its consciousness is developed. Actually, this spiritual spark is wonderful. If we can understand ourselves as a spiritual person, as a spiritual part of God, part of the Supreme Lord, we realize that we are eternal. We never die, we're never born. That is actually the perfection of knowledge. That is the true understanding of life. In this world, people are suffering. Why? You read the newspaper every day, we have so many problems in the world. Sometimes people say, what is the Hare Krishna movement doing for the problems in the world? And although we feed hundreds of thousands, even millions of people every day, prasadam around the world, we do various types of, they consider, well, these activities because it's feeding, or specifically those welfare activities that we do which are more visibly in relation to the body, they consider this to be the most important activity. And the spiritual dissemination of knowledge is considered maybe to be much lower in its priority or value. It's unfortunate in one sense. But actually, because if you study what are the problems in the world, just like there's so many wars going on at present. There's something like 45 wars going on in the world. Most of these, a lot of these are due to exploitation, various sentiments, that someone is born as a Sikh, or born as a Hindu, or born as a Tamil, or born as a Sinhalese, or born as a Sunni, or a Shiite Muslim, or born as a Jew, or born as a Palestinian. And so they identify themselves with that particular body. And just like a cat is like an enemy of the dogs, or the dogs are enemies with cats. As soon as a cat and dog meet, they'll immediately, spontaneously have some enmity. Due to all these whites and blacks, or the various types of bodily distinction, there's so much prejudice, hatred, envy, even wars going on in the world. It's not actually due to religion even. It's due to a racial kind of outlook. Why? Because people don't realize that they're not the body. They don't realize that now they've taken birth in this particular country, in this particular family, but that doesn't mean that's their real identity. Just like someone may belong to the diners club, but then he may resign and join another club. Or someone may be of one nationality and change, or wear one set of clothes and then change it. These are not our real identity. These are not actually our real nature. We're the living force within the body. When the body dies, we go on. We don't die. So someone may be born American in this life, next life he may be born a Russian. Because when he's dying, if he's thinking of the Russians, he may next birth take birth as a Russian. Those who are dying fighting the contras, and they may next birth be on the opposite side. Whatever you think about when you die, that's what you attain. So, in this way, of course, that's a special advantage for thinking about Krishna. At the time of death, then you go back to Krishna. Not that you become Krishna, but you go to the planet of Krishna, go back to the spiritual world. But we can discuss that later. What we're discussing now is that about the soul, about ourselves. The people, they're born into this world, and then they simply identify that, well, this is my mother, this is my father, this is who I am. And then according to that, they form an opinion of themselves. Then maybe due to various philosophical, ideological developments, then they start to may identify themselves according to their ism. I'm a follower of communism, or I'm a follower of capitalism, or I'm a follower of altruism or humanism. This all becomes on the mental platform. And that may change. Someone may be a pragmatist and then later on become a liberalist or become... And this way it may change according to the environment, according to one's development of thought. Just like the philosophies that are prevalent in the world, in the West, they continually are undergoing various changes. Now America is going through a conservative mood. In the past it went through other different changes. Who knows what is... the mood that is going to be in the future. So, people identify with their body or with their mental outlook, and then they assign friends and enemies, likes and dislikes. And this way, they are trying to find different allies for their struggle with life, different friends, associates. And then as that changes, their relationships change. Since these things are always changing. Even people come together as friends, and later as their attitudes change, they part again. They even become enemies sometimes. So friendship on the basis of having a similar outlook on life, that is not very permanent because outlooks may change. And friendships are on the basis of having some similar caste or creed or color or birth relationship. That is even on a lower level of simply bodily identification. So actually the real friendship is that which is based on the intelligence or based on the soul. The Bhagavad Gita specifically deals with the level of intelligence above the physical and mental level. To understand through intelligence, where am I? Am I the body that's always changing? Am I the mind that's always changing its outlook? No, actually, to understand, I am the soul. I am the living entity. I am that spiritual spark, that spiritual dynamic force that's in the body. And then to realize that that spiritual force has an origin. It's a part of Krishna. Krishna says, Mamai Vamsa Jiva Loka Jiva Bhuta Sanatana. All the living entities are my part and parcel. Whatever qualities we have, we're a little microcosm of God. We possess in a small, minute fraction, basic qualities which are originally existent in God. Only difficulty is that we are not perfect, therefore in us these qualities are conflict, or they are impure, or perverted in different ways, in many cases, in many examples. Where in the Supreme Lord they are perfect, they are all good. So, if we understand the nature of the self, then we can see, well, everyone in the world, they're all coming from the same source. They're all the same spiritual quality. But they're covered by various material coverings. Depending on the covering, that's how their consciousness is coming through. Just like if you wear glasses, sunglasses. If you wear yellow glasses, you see everything is yellow. If you wear red glasses, you see everything is red. If you wear black, you see everything, or dark blue, everything is blue. So according to the color of glass that you're wearing, sunglasses, or then you'll see everything with that shade. So similarly, depending on the type of body that covers the soul, that's how their consciousness comes out. Now, in the animal species, the consciousness is very deeply covered, considered like a child in the womb. A child in the womb is embryo. It's not developed. Only when the child becomes born will it actually develop at its full consciousness. In the womb, it's not able to manifest that. It's a potential. Some of the animals, they have consciousness, but their consciousness will not fully develop till they leave the animal species and come up to the human species. They have consciousness. They feel pain and pleasure. They have intelligence. Just like, for instance, if you take the example of a cat, say a wife, some cats like to eat fish. In India, there was a housewife, and she was cooking a fish. And the cat was just watching from outside the kitchen what she's doing. And the housewife, she leaves the kitchen and goes somewhere. And at that time, just seeing the opportune moment, the cat runs in, grabs the fish, and runs off. She comes back, there's no more fish. Where'd it go? Isn't that intelligent? So the cat has intelligence, not that they have no intelligence, but their intelligence is limited to how to eat, how to catch a mouse. They stalk their mouse. The tigers in the jungle, they're very clever. They wait for the... In Bengal, we went to recently on a tour of the Sundarbans. Sundarbans are the jungles on the very southern part of Bengal and Bangladesh. This was in Bangladesh. We had to go 30 miles off of the paved road. And we reached this very remote village where they wanted to sponsor the program. And just a week before, there were two villagers who had gone to get honey from the Sundarban forest. And the tigers can swim. And the tiger swam next to the boat and just took the boat and pulled it in and grabbed the people and swam off. So they're clever. They know how to get their prey, how to get what they want. So you know, a human being maybe can be trained to be more clever. Actually, that's not the real perfection of human intelligence, just how to be more clever at defending oneself or at how to get enough food to eat or a place to sleep or how to impress someone else so we can have some nice friendship, find a boyfriend or a girlfriend. That type of intelligence is there in the animals. They're making friends. They're having families. Even the lion cub takes 2 years before it can really go hunting on its own. So the lion take their baby cubs wherever they go, feed the cubs, protect the cubs, pick them up. They have their family life. It's not that family life is exclusive to the human being. In fact, in India, a calf dies, the mother cries, the cow cries for the calf sometimes. So what the farmer does is sometimes the cow is so sad if the calf dies, it stops giving milk. So then the farmer takes the dead calf and skins it and stuffs it and then hangs it up in front of the cow. And the cow can smell it's my calf. Then it feels happy and starts giving milk again. Doesn't realize that this is not my calf, it's just the dead skin of the calf. Calf is dead. Doesn't have that developed intelligence. So like this, but in the animal kingdom, they also have family life. It's not that only humans have family life. The mother bird brings food home for the little babies when the eggs hatch. The human being has that real capacity to understand I'm not the body. You can't tell a dog, you're not a dog. You're an eternal living entity. You were born before a cat, now you become a dog, in the next life you'll become a horse or something. You know, you're wasting your time. The dog going under, ruff, ruff, yeah, that's it. You know. Tell me all about it. I just want, you know, my dog food. Right? So that's where the animals are actually different from human beings. They don't have the intelligence to understand who is God, what is life, what this philosophical thing, that they don't have the capacity. But human beings do. So actually, Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, when he came to the Western world, his concern was that here we have America, we have a leading nation in the world, we have these very advanced, materially advanced technological nations. And they developed science and to such a degree, but unfortunately, they haven't understood the difference between animal life and human life, or the difference of the purpose of human life. That actually human life is meant ultimately to achieve liberation from the whole material world, to achieve freedom from this type of bodily consciousness, to come to a higher level of God consciousness, of Krishna consciousness, to come to a level where we realize I'm a part of God. We can see how everyone else is also part of God, that we can actually have a true brotherhood based on having a common father, based on having a common origin, common root. Our forefathers of this particular body may be from Africa or from Germany or from in America. Everybody comes from somewhere else except for the Red Indians, and we don't know where they come from originally, thousands of years before. They may also have come from somewhere else. So everyone can trace back their material history. But that's not their real identity. It's not that one necessarily has to again and again be born in the same family. Rather, the opposite is normally true. That we're not usually born in the same family. We're born in different places in different families, in most cases. So actually, we don't know our real identity. We don't know who we are until we come to the point of understanding what is life. This is our Lord Chaitanya. He's explaining there are 8,400,000 species of life in the world. These are different species. The soul, this minute soul, transmigrates between the different species. He explains, O Lord, although the living entities who have accepted material bodies are spiritual and unlimited in number, if they were all pervading, there would be no question of their being under your control. If they are accepted, however, as particles of the eternally existing spiritual entity, as part of you, who are the supreme spirit whole, we must conclude that they are always under your control. If the living entities are simply satisfied with being identical with you as spiritual particles, then they will be happy being controllers of so many things. The conclusion that the living entities and the Supreme Personality of Godhead are one and the same is a faulty conclusion. It is not a fact. Once we accept, first Lord Chaitanya explained there are many living entities in different species, and these are all these spiritual parts. Nowadays, people are coming to know more and more the whole New Age movement. They're coming to understand, well, we're a spiritual force. And this spiritual power is within us. It can be developed. It can be brought out. But then, where does this force come from? What is the nature? Is this spiritual particle, this spiritual soul, God? And the answer is given here that the spiritual part is the same quality as God. The same quality, but not the same quantity. Just like a drop in the ocean is salty, but in a drop you don't find whales or sharks, you just find some microorganisms. But the salty part of the water, you find the same basic, similar saltiness is there, similar composition of the water is there. But there's in an ocean of water, there's many other things which won't fit in a drop. Similarly, within the Supreme Soul, there are many different degrees of the same quality. But the basic qualities are not different. So here are some philosophical points are given that would sound a little bit complicated. Now, if the soul was all-pervading, in other words, if we're actually an all-pervasive soul, and that we are just penned up in the body when we realize ourselves, we realize I'm all pervasive. I'm God. If that was the thing, that was the actual thing that we are to realize, that I am God. In that case, then why are we under control now of this body? Why do we have to become liberated? If we are actually all pervasive, then how we get covered up? In other words, if we are God, people now, a lot of people think, I am God. This is a very popular notion. We are God in quality, not in quantity. There's a supreme God. If we are God, there's still supreme God. We're not supreme God. We're small parts of God. If we were God, then we would be all pervasive. Then we wouldn't be under the control of this world, under this body. We wouldn't be limited like this. We wouldn't be forced to get traffic tickets and get all kinds of difficulties as we're doing this. We wouldn't be under this control of the body where we identify that we are this material body. How can you bring the all-pervasive God under this limited bodily? But if you accept, as it says here, but if they are accepted, however, as particles of the eternally existing spiritual entity, as part of you, the supreme spirit, if we're just one part, then we can be covered. If we're all-pervasive, if we are God, then how we can be covered? You see, it's a big mistake people are making nowadays. Many people think, I'm God. They start to realize they're as part of God, their spiritual force, their spiritual reality. But then they go a next step and think, now so we are God. It's a mistake. God, by definition, can never be brought under illusion. We were in illusion, now we're starting to realize who we are, our spiritual identity, our spiritual potential. That means we're starting to awaken. That means we are covered, we were in illusion. So that if we are actually God, we can't be brought in illusion. The Krishna consciousness is not to teach people they're God, to teach we're part of God. Being part of it, knowing who I am, is the most important thing. If I think I'm someone I'm not, it's like a form of insanity. If someone thinks he's Napoleon and he walks around with his hand in his shirt, I mean, people will just think he's nuts. It won't have any practical value. If I go around thinking I am God, it may satisfy my ego. But in reality, if I'm not God, then what is the use of it? But if I realize, who is God? What is my relationship with God? What is actually my real position in the universe? That is valuable. That is what we need to know. If someone knows exactly how he fits in, he can be ahead of everyone. Just like why you find that all his lawyers, they make good progress mostly in politics. Because they know, studying law, what is the whole government system. So they have an advantage over the ordinary person who may not understand all the intricacies of the system. If you know the whole universal situation, how you fit in, what is your relationship with the universe, with nature, with the laws of nature, with the Supreme Lord, with other living entities, even from a material point of view, your position is far beyond anyone else's. This ordinary things that disturb and cause others great problems will not affect you. Just like a small child becomes very upset over little things that are not important. In the world today, we're having wars. People are mass murder of each other over illusion. They don't even realize who they are, and they're fighting on some racial or some kind of very obvious illusion and ignorance. So Srila Prabhupada, Bhaktivedanta Swami, he said that the most important welfare work that can be done in the world today is to waken up the leading people of the world to their realized spiritual identity, waking them up from this type of base animal outlook on life, where they see themselves just as a virile kind of animal, based on their body, based on their color. And they suffer because of that. Everyone is suffering. So, being a human being is therefore a very, very important opportunity. Opportunity knocks in the human form of life. We can take opportunity of the human intelligence to understand what is the real purpose of life, how do we fit in, and then to act in that proper consciousness. Then the modern technology, modern everything, amenities, they can all be used in a proper manner. Vedic culture, there should be total harmony between man and his environment. Because of lack of the spiritual knowledge, our ecology is also being destroyed. Instead of thinking of the overall welfare of the planet, of the universe, of the human being, we're thinking only of very limited economic goals, which in the long run are going to cause not only economic disaster, but other forms of disaster as well. But actually, Krishna consciousness is the most that we would humbly submit for all of you present. It's actually the most important welfare work that could be done, is to educate the people on the science of Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam, the science of the soul, science of life. It's not that there's nothing missing in the Western world. Here in America, what's missing? There's plenty of video, there's plenty of things to see, things to do, things to eat. There's so many. There's clothes, there's houses, there's vehicles, there's everything. Why are still people not fully satisfied? Why are people have to take shelter of drugs and so many things just to get some happiness? Why they're not complete in themselves? They have all the material facilities. These are very important questions. The Prabhupada said that actually the people in America, they have everything. You see, they're good looking, they're intelligent, they have all these material possessions. Only thing they're missing is the spiritual knowledge. They're missing Krishna consciousness. If they have God consciousness, if they have the spiritual consciousness, then everything else fits into place. Otherwise, like Jesus said, you can't take anything with you. You see, all material possessions are rather obstacles to go into the spiritual world, all the material possessions. But according to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, if you use the material possessions in Krishna's service, if you know the proper use of them, they're not an obstacle. They can also be an aid. If you know that I'm not actually the owner, I'm just like a lessee. I'm having these for some time, but they're not going to stay with me. They're ultimately the property of the Supreme Lord. I can use what I need for my maintenance, and if there's surplus, I should use it for His service. So, these are some of the highlights of Krishna consciousness. So, of course, for us, Krishna is very special, being that not only, of course, there are many forms and many names of God, and Krishna is the original. But for the devotees, even more than just the title or the position of being the Supreme Lord, that actually the more they know about Krishna as a person, as an individual, that the more they develop a fascination, an attraction, an attachment, a love. It's very practical. I mean, it's much easier if you develop love by knowing about someone than just kind of theoretical. So Krishna, He has so many wonderful qualities. Just like yesterday we observed the appearance day of Krishna when He came as Nrsingadev, where He came and protected His devotee. Devotee was being persecuted and He was asked that you say God is all pervasive, He's everywhere. Well, I'm going to kill you right now. Now will your God come and save you? Was He here? Is He here in this pillar? If I smash down this pillar, will He come and save you? Come on, let's see your God save you now. I'm going to kill you, you! And He cursed and cursed this little boy. He said, I'm going to kill you. Now I'm going to save you. And He smashes the column. And said, just see, now you're death. And all of a sudden, out of the column comes Nrsingadev. Couldn't believe it. Someone did come out of the column, just out of nowhere, and protected His devotee. So there's that quality that the Lord always protects His devotee. Then there's like when Krishna was with His friends, the Pandavas, and He established them as the rulers of the planet. And then Krishna was going back to His own place when He was here 5,000 years ago, having His pastime. And then His auntie, so-called auntie, and He appeared in a certain family, and so some people considered themselves some relation. She said, although I'm supposed to be your auntie, I know who you are. You're the Supreme Lord. You're the Lord of everyone, and actually only your pure devotees can have you. And she offered so many wonderful prayers. These are in the prayers of Queen Kunti, a wonderful book published by the Bhaktivedanta Book Trust. Requested Krishna, you please stay, don't go now. Then Krishna went on. He accepted all these prayers, but it wasn't enough to stop him. But then he came and there was a friend, Yudhisthira, who was at that time, this had just been made the emperor, but he actually had a deep affection for Krishna. And when he saw Krishna leaving, he just grabbed Krishna's hand and he was just crying. And he said, Krishna, just please stay for a few more days. And because it was so filled with love and affection, so Krishna's all right for you also. And he couldn't say no to His devotee. Like this, there are so many different little things, but you read about, hear about Krishna from devotees. You see, if you hear about Krishna from someone who's not a devotee, they give their own interpretation or they just add something. They don't know the inner nectar about that. They don't actually have a flavor, they don't have a taste, but they just present it in some dry way. And you won't get the real feeling. To really know about Krishna, one has to, just like if you want to know about someone, you hear about him from a friend and you can get some real inner insight. If you want to know about Krishna, you need to hear from a devotee of Krishna. Then you can get an actual feeling for the Supreme Lord, for what He's like. If you hear from an atheist or some, person that doesn't believe that there's a personality of Godhead, they'll just speak in a very dry fashion, which you won't be able to get the real taste for it. Just like Krishna had a friend. He was a school friend. He was very poor. His name was Viprasudama. And he was a Brahmin. Krishna was, that means like a priest. And Krishna, he played the role as the son of a king. It was like the part he was playing when he was in Dwaraka. So the Vipra-Sudama, his friend, his wife kept pestering him. We're so poor. We don't have anything in our house. Our roof has leaks in it, and we don't have, look at my clothes, they're old, and I have nothing. You know? And you have the richest friend, you have Krishna. He's a big, rich king. I even hear he's like a supreme lord or something. You come down, you got everything there, just in Dwaraka. Why don't you go and just help give us a little something, you know? We're so poor, you know. How can I ask Krishna for anything? He's my friend. We were there as schoolmates together when Krishna accepted a guru, Sandapani Muni, to teach everyone that everyone requires a spiritual master or a guru. That time, Vipra-Sudama was also a student of the same guru. So this way they had like a school friend. Sita, let me go and see Krishna. This is an opportunity. My wife would never let me go. If I said, let me go and see Krishna, she'll never let me go. But now, because she's thinking I'll get something, she's telling me to go. So now I'll take the chance. So he went next door and he begged some. He didn't have anything. His house was empty. So he went and begged some chipped rice, chira, and wrapped it up in his cloth. And he went off to Dwaraka to see Krishna. So when he went to see Krishna, and finally he reached Dwaraka, he said, there's so many huge palaces, beautiful palaces and gardens and wonderful arrangement there, fountains. He came to the main gate, and there the gate just opened, and the gatekeeper said, Krishna is waiting for you, go right in. So he walks in, he goes to the various gates, and finally goes right up into the inner quarters where Krishna is there. Soon as Krishna sees him, he offers respect. He welcomes his friend. He said, now, well, you're a Brahmin. You're a priestly person. I'm just, kingly person, so I have to worship the priest. You please sit down. He has him sit in his own seat, his private throne, bathes his feet, has his queen, Rukmini, the goddess of fortune, fanning him. And this way, then they're talking. After the formality, they're talking and saying, tell me, how are you? How is everything? Vipra-Sudama couldn't say to Krishna, well, actually, you know, we're really broke, you know, we need a little cash. He couldn't say. He said, no, everything is all right, actually. I'm always thinking about you. I'm so happy to be here, you know. And he couldn't bring himself to just ask for a handout. Instead, he was just so happy to be with Krishna, and Krishna was so kind to him and just so personal. Even though he was a very insignificant person, he considered himself, except Krishna is treating him with so much respect and affection. Then Krishna saw that he had this in his cloth. This is like a system sometime in the village. There are all these cloths that were, and they put the grain inside, and then they just tie it like this. So he's carrying like that over his shoulder the grain. I said, what have you got there? Is that something for me? I think you bought this for me. Let me try some. He said, no, this is actually I brought for you, but it's not really good. No, you brought for me, then let me see. I want to have some. He said, no, actually. He said, how can Krishna is living in such opulence? What, this some just ordinary cereal I got from the next door neighbor. How can I give this to Krishna? So Krishna, no, let me see. He just took it and opened it up. Oh, my favorite flat rice cereal. Let me try a little bit. Oh, I love cereal brought by my devotees. I mean, chira is the type of, for the West, I mean, it's cereal. So he took it. Oh, let me try again. This is very good. He said, no, don't take it. It's not good enough. Said, no, this, what do you mean? He went to take a third time. Rukmini, his queen, put, please, don't take any more. Why? What's the matter? You know, I said, that whatever you take in charity, whatever your devotee offers you, I have to give them a blessing. If someone gives you any donation or any service, then I reciprocate and I bless them so many times in return. So, but he didn't give from his own wealth. He has no personal wealth. He went and begged this from the next door neighbor. That means he gave from beyond his own capacity. And he's giving to you. So that means when he gave you the first donation, you took the first bite, I have to give him all the, as much opulences as there is in the universe. I have to give so much. And when you took it the second time, that means I have to get equal with you, which is even that's not possible for me, how I can get equal to you. But if you take this third time, since he took from someone else, that means I have to give at least equal to what he did. I have to give him more opulence than you have. Because he's giving from more than what he has. And I can't give more than what you have. That's impossible. There's nothing more than you. So don't take three times from, please, I'll be in big trouble how to give him a blessing for whatever service he's doing. So then Krishna so anyway, Vipra, I don't think he, I don't know how much he could really pick up what was going on when Rukmini was talking. But anyway, then Krishna, and they spent some time, and then he went, again, he took leave from Krishna, and they embraced each other. And then he went back to go to his house. Then he was going back, said, oh no, my wife is going to say, what did you get from Krishna? I didn't ask for anything. How could I ask for anything? Krishna is so wonderful. Krishna was, and he was just thinking, so happy just that he could be the friend of Krishna. That Krishna was so kind, and he was just actually, his relation, he was just in love with Krishna as a friend. That is the perfection. If you love God, there's nothing higher than that. I mean, every great religious leader, whether Jesus, Muhammad, they also, there's no higher perfection than loving God, to surrender and love to God. So this is a natural way. If you know about him, if you're a friend of him, well, what could be higher than that? So then Vipra-siddhama, he finally gets back near to where his house is, and then he looks to where his house is. He doesn't see anymore. Where's my heart? Someone has built some big building is there over my hut. Instead, there's this big palace. Some palace has come up here, some kind of big multi-story building. What's that in this? He approaches, then his wife, so he sees some beautiful lady come with some maid servants and everything, and he sees it's his wife and says, wow, someone has come here and given us all these things. I said, it must have been Krishna. How is it that he didn't even, thank you for having Krishna give us all these things. I didn't say anything to Krishna. So then he thought, oh, what to do? If I reject it, that won't be polite. So instead he just used it as one very big temple and used it all for Krishna's service. And from there he trained people how to serve Krishna, and he glorified Krishna. So he never took it that well, because Krishna gave it, now let me just use it for myself. He thought, let me use it for Krishna. Of course he lived there, but he used it for Krishna. So like this, Krishna is very kind to his devotee. He knows in their heart what they want. If someone wants something and they're serving Krishna, even without asking, he'll fulfill their desire. And if someone realizes the best thing is to want to just be a devotee of Krishna, or to, if they want knowledge, to, if they want to be a devotee, if they want material things, whatever they want, that becomes very easily fulfilled by practicing Krishna consciousness. Whether one doesn't, this beginning doesn't have so much understanding about Krishna, but they dislike the philosophy, or they like the spiritual process, even if they practice the process, even without a great understanding, if they go through their practice and lead this natural lifestyle, whether in the temple or in their own house, that will gradually help to bring up their spiritual potential to the highest point. And then gradually they'll get the wisdom to understand what is the world, who are they, who is Krishna, what is the Supreme Lord, what are the energies that are making this world go on. Everything they can understand very easily. So thank you very much for coming here to this Krishna Conscious Center. And we hope that you enjoy the feast today, and that you can make friends with some of the devotees that are here and learn more about this Krishna conscious mission. We truly need people from within, from without, from all walks of life to help in spreading this consciousness, spreading the consciousness. People understand who they are. If they can understand they're not the body, they're the eternal spirit soul. If they can understand these basic truths of life, this will go the longest way for solving the major problems in the world. Then the minor problems, they can be solved easily. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. Are there any questions? The manor. Recently, the group of the people, devotees, and a counselor from the English manor, Bhaktivedanta manor, donated by George Harrison, which the local village government wants to close off from being visited by the Indian Hindus from London, because they say that so many come, 50,000 come on the big festive days, so they say the village gets overwhelmed, so they wanted to close it off. But actually traffic studies show that the people are very orderly and very well behaved, and it's not, you know, once a year, this huge crowd doesn't even pose a big problem. There's plenty of parking space and everything. So, but it became, as you know, more or less kind of a racial thing.